And this afternoon we will venture into an entirely different method, and it's qualitatively very different in a number of very significant ways than the mindfulness of breathing. I want to give a fairly short introduction. This, of course, is settling the mind in its natural state. In the Gelugpa tradition, it's called simply taking the mind as your object of shamatha, shamatha focused on the mind. And many people find it quite difficult. Some people just take to it like a duck takes to water. Just slip into it, they love it. So a lot of variety there. And what I would like to do is just make it as user-friendly as I possibly can as we make our first entry. Now, of course, we'll cycle back to it in about 2 weeks, and we'll cycle back to it another 2 weeks or so later. But, of course, the problem that so many people encounter when venturing into this practice is they're told, on the one hand, observe whatever thoughts, images, and so forth come up. But as soon as the thought comes up, they're already thinking it. They're already grabbed by it. Their attention is focusing on the referent of the thought. So they're really not observing at all. They're just thinking it. And they're always aware of the thought only retrospectively. And that can give rise to kind of an ongoing sense of kind of frustration and feeling, I just can't do this, can't do this. So, Nicola, please come on time, okay? Like everybody do that. Mutual courtesy all the way around. I show up on time, everybody else shows on time. And so, no interruption. And I know you are very sincere. I have no question. Okay. Hola, so back to the topic. So there's the problem, that we're just carried away by our thoughts all the time. So what's the solution? And you're going to hear me say this so many times, you're going to think, this must be the solution to all problems. It's not, but it's a solution to a lot of problems. And that is? Relax, yeah. Relax. It really is the solution. And that is get loose, chill, melt, slow down, get loose, you know, like jellyfish. You know, so that the thoughts come up, and they come up and they're trying to grab onto you, but you're Teflon. You're a jellyfish. There's just nothing to grab onto. Whereas if you come out like this to the thoughts, man, they got all kinds of hooks to pull you away, you know? So that is the solution. And that's why we do have this kind of first gear, second gear, third gear, three modes of mindfulness of breathing before shifting into fourth gear, settling the mind in its natural state. So I want to give just one analogy, and then I'm eager to plunge in. But here's an analogy you may find helpful. You drink it in now. If it's helpful, it's helpful. If it's not, it's not. But don't visualize it during the practice, okay? I'm going to give you some images. You may have heard it before on the podcast, maybe not. But here it is. This is the best I can do in terms of giving you the ambience, the feel of it, okay? So imagine that you live in some major industrial city. And if I'm in America, I say like Detroit. And you're really wanting to get off to some beautiful tropical isle, some idyllic setting, your best shot of utopia. And you think, okay, Tahiti, or who knows, Phuket. But let's stick with Tahiti. And so you save up your money for a long time, and this is going to be the vacation to end all vacations. You're so looking forward to it. You got like 1 week in Tahiti, right? You save it up. You arrive. You put your luggage in your hotel. And you head out to the beach, and then what do? Now you're here to, boy, savor every single moment of Tahiti. It took you maybe a year to save up the money for this week, and you wanted to savor every moment of it, right? This is the time to really enjoy yourself and relax and enjoy every aspect of Tahiti. So what do? What's your first thing off is you get yourself an air mattress. You blow it up, and then you take your air mattress out, and you get beyond the waves, you know. And then you get out there where there's just gentle swell. And it's one of those perfect, not too hot, not too cold days, puffy clouds, the volcanic islands, the crystal clear water. And you lie on your back on the air mattress and you go, I'm in Tahiti. And the last thing you want to do is fall asleep. Because if you fall asleep, you may as well be back in Detroit. Right? Then what was the point of all of this trouble? So you want to be savoring every single moment, and you want to be totally relaxed. Now is your chance, but not so relaxed you fall asleep. Otherwise, you know, you could be dreaming that you're back in Detroit. So then what's the point again? So imagine there you are, just going in the Shavasana on your air mattress, and you're feeling this gentle undulation because you're beyond the surf, the gentle swell, the rise, and then the fall, the rise, and the fall, like rockabye baby on the ocean, you know. Oh, and it's so relaxing, and you just don't want to miss it, miss a moment of it, because it's so choice. I mean, you spent a lot of money to be able to get here. And so up and down, relaxing and just savoring, enjoying the warmth of the sun. And then after some time, you kind of, wow, this is really cool. But you brought your mask and a snorkel. And you know the water here is crystal clear, and you can see fish, you can see coral. So after some time, you say, well, this is really nice to relax, but man, the water is so crystal clear. And look at the coral beds down there. So you roll over on your tummy, put on the mask, and put just your head down under the water. And now you've got a mask on. You can see crystal clear. You can see 50 feet, 10, 15, 30 meters. You know, it's crystal clear, like there's nothing there. And you see the coral, and you just rest there. And then you see the fish swimming through and swimming through. And, oh, it's another whole world there. It's so beautiful that you can hardly take your eyes off. At the same time, you're on top of your air mattress. So you're still feeling the rise and fall. But you're getting some nice entertainment here, too. Ah, there's some fish going by, and oh, look at that coral over there. And, wow, so cool, so cool. And then after a while, this is really nice, but you're thinking, oh, you feel the temperature of the water. It's perfect. Not chill, but not too warm, you know, like bathtub. You say, oh, why should I stay on top of the air mattress? The water's perfect. So you slip off the air mattress, and you just hold on with one hand, you know, point of orientation. And there you are, it's salt water. And so you can float, especially with a little hand there. And now you put your hand down, you're breathing normally through your snorkel, and now it's more of like a total immersion experience, like you're seeing everything, you're kind of in the medium, and you're just maintaining a peripheral awareness of the rise and fall of the air mattress as you're really giving like 90% of your attention. Oh, so beautiful, so cool, wow, what's coming up next? Never know what's coming up next, you know? And up and down. And then after a while you recognize, hey, this is salt water. I'm going to float here. I don't need to do this. I'm not going to drown. I just hang out here and I'll float right on the surface. So then you let go of the air mattress altogether and you give 100% of your attention just to observing this water wonderland. And total immersion, 100% there. And wow, I'm in Tahiti. How cool, how cool. Okay. You ready to go to Tahiti? or leave here and go off to the beach? Okay, and as I said, don't visualize that when we're doing the practice. Now, I think you probably figured out the stages there. We're going to start in the next session with this full body, the infirmary, or sitting up in the infirmary. Full body awareness, mindfulness of breathing, the rise and fall, the gentle undulation of the ripples of the breath throughout the body, giving that our full attention, right? And really soothing, relaxing. You haven't come to Tahiti, but you have in fact come to Phuket, you know? So there it is. And so there you are. But then after some time, as you're maintaining this very gentle, soothing, and quietly enjoyable, or at least peaceful, flow of mindfulness, of the sensations arising in the body, the ebb and flow of the breath, then you kind of turn on introspection. Turn on introspection, of course, the other faculty, and especially monitoring the mind, more peripheral, while you're primarily focusing on the sensations of the breath and the body. But, okay, introspection, monitoring whatever's coming up in the mind, right? And then as you get into it more, you find, oh, what's coming up in the mind is kind of interesting. So then you may kind of shift the focus more over to the mind, that is, have the main bulk of your mindfulness come over, oh, what's taking place in the mind? It's not quite as predictable as in-breath, out-breath. You never know what's coming up, the next image, the next fish, the next thought, you know, whatever's coming up. And so more of a segue over there, but still this very relaxed mode, soothing mode, enjoying mode. What's coming up in the mind? Just to watch it, like, again, like watching the depths of the sea. And then after you get more and more into it, you can see, we just see thoughts arising and images coming up and memories coming up and this coming up and just kind of just appearing in the space of the mind and then dissolving away like a fireworks display. As you kind of just get the hang of it, get into the flow of it, then you may really marginalize your awareness of the breath, just holding on a little bit, point of reference, in-breath, something to hold on to, in-breath, out-breath, kind of just keeping the beat, keeping the rhythm, yeah? But like 90% of your awareness really going to what's taking place in the mind. Ah, so interesting, moment to moment, who can tell what's coming up next? And then as you get into the flow of that and you're really relaxing into it, without grasping, just being attentive, then you see, you know, I don't really need to give deliberately give any of my attention to the breath. I can just go here and free float and give all of my attention to single-pointedly now, shamatha focused on the space of the mind and whatever arises in it, like the person that's just floating free and giving all of his or her attention to the space of the ocean, whatever fish or and so forth are swimming through it. So I gave all of that. That took a little while. But the idea is more the ambience, the feel of it, and the gradual segue that you can do that can be quite smooth. And that's really what I'm trying to invite you here, is that we're not doing an abrupt transition to some radically different method that's really hard and frustrating and difficult, but try anyway. No, let's try a very smooth, sequential, gradual way where you're just kind of gradually segueing or shifting the focus of your attention from the flow of the sensations in the body and then over until you're 100% on space of the mind and its contents. Okay? So maybe that imagery was useful. At least it was pretty. So please do find a comfortable position, supine or sitting, as you wish. Letting your awareness descend into the body. Let your body settle in its natural state as you let your respiration come and settle in its natural rhythm. And for a short time, calm the discursive mind with mindfulness of breathing. Like that person lying on the air mattress, let your awareness permeate the whole field of the body and gently maintain a mindfulness of the flow of the in-breath, the out-breath, relaxing and relaxing again with each exhalation. to the best of your ability, maintain an ongoing, continuous flow of mindfulness, of the ongoing, continuous flow of sensations of the breath throughout the body. Let these sensations occupy your mind continuously. Then open the portal of introspection. This faculty of mind that enables you to monitor the mind itself, whatever is occurring in terms of thoughts, images, whether the mind is agitated, whether it's calm, whether it's clear or dull. Now, as you note thoughts and images arising in the space of the mind, give a bit more attention to this domain of experience. And let your eyes be at least a little bit open, while letting your gaze rest vacantly in the space in front of you, without deliberately giving any attention to the visual field. So for a little while, we are indeed multitasking, maintaining some awareness of the in and out flow of the breath, but now focusing our attention with greater interest on the thoughts and images that arise in the space of the mind. once again, as we attend closely to some phenomenon that we can influence, we tend to influence it. But to the best of your ability, as you note thoughts and images arising, simply observe their nature without seeking to modify, control, or influence them in any way. Just let them be, arising and passing of their own accord. If you find yourself frequently getting lost in thoughts, simply carried away, shift back a bit. Engage more with the sensations of the in and out breath. Get yourself grounded, relaxed, loose. With your faculty of introspection, when you see that you have succumbed to excitation, been carried away by some thought, recall the remedy. Relax, release, and return. as you become more accustomed to the practice, more confident, then you may release your mindfulness of the breathing altogether and focus as single-pointedly as you can upon the space of the mind. And whatever thoughts, images, and other mental events arise within that domain of experience, which is to say that you are not deliberately giving attention to any of the five physical senses or sense fields, but only to the domain of the mind, single-pointedly. With your faculty of introspection, note not only the occurrence of excitation or distraction, but also in this practice you may be especially prone to simply spacing out, unsure of what you're attending to. When you fall into such laxity or dullness, then freshly arouse your attention and focus clearly on the space of the mind and whatever is arising within that space right now. Lasso. So for the mindfulness of breathing practices that we engaged in for 3 days, those are straightforward shamatha practices. There's no aspect of them really that is vipassana or insight practice. Straightforward. Shamatha practice, 100%. Now in the Buddha's primary discourse on mindfulness of breathing, called the Anapanasati Sutta, his discourse on the mindfulness of in and out breathing, in fact he teaches 16 phases of mindfulness of breathing. And the first four are straight shamatha. And the last 12 are vipassana. So that one vehicle of mindfulness of breathing can segue from shamatha into vipassana. And in fact, the culminating phase is to achieve arhatship. So mindfulness of breathing can be a vehicle all the way to becoming an arhat. This practice that we're doing here is right on the cusp of vipassana. It is a shamatha practice. That's the way it's taught in the Mahamudra tradition, the Dzogchen tradition, the Gelugpa tradition, and so forth. It's a shamatha practice, which is to say, if you practice it effectively, carry it to its culmination, you'll achieve shamatha. That's what it's for. But the nature of the practice, the fact that we're bringing such discerning, ongoing flow of intelligent mindfulness to the space of the mind, observing events arise and pass, rise and pass, we're right on the cusp of insight, right? In other words, could insights arise, very important, transformative, insights arise from this practice? The answer is yes. No question. And so if you should check with some Vipassana teacher, and there are a lot of good ones around, and if you just describe this practice that we just did, but without labeling it, say, here's a practice I was taught, and just describe it, and you ask them, how would you label that practice? Many of them might very well say, that's Vipassana. And I'm not going to debate with them. Right? It's right on the cusp. So you're kind of getting double benefit. It is for the cultivation of relaxation, stability, and vividness. It's shamatha. But doing that one practice with no additions, nothing more to it, just that focus of mindfulness, can clearly give rise to some very deep insights into the nature of the mind. And so it's right next door, just next door to what in Pali is called citta satipatthana, the close application of mindfulness to the mind. And that is bona fide vipassana practice. Okay? So there's a lot more to the vipassana practice of the close application of mindfulness to the mind, a lot more to it, as you can see from the Buddha's own teachings on it, a lot more than simply bare attention, watching what's arising and passing. But this is certainly right next to it. Okay? So that's a brief introduction. I'd like now to turn to discussion, and I'd actually like to invite Meek, first of all, to raise a question, because it follows immediately upon the series of questions he raised yesterday, and they're actually very relevant to this practice as well. So if I can invite you, Meek, microphone coming, and then we'll turn it open, and I see it. there's two questions here as well, or two papers, let's see.
Thank you. So I thought about the answer you gave yesterday. And I thought about the first days of retreat I had here and the difficulties in my tummy, feeling-wise, mm-hmm. that I had that brought me to this question.
Right.
I had a few occasions where in my mind, in my thoughts, mm-hmm. intellectually and to my understanding also, I had solved some kind of issue that yes. had troubled me.
Yeah.
But then again, I still had a, shit feeling in my tummy mm-hmm. that was really inhibiting my practice, was making it very difficult to concentrate and just so on. Mm-hmm. But to the best of my conscious understanding, I had solved the issue in my mind that I had. Mm-hmm. So what is it, and what is this feeling that inhibits, and how to get rid of it?
Very good, very good. Let's take an analogy. Let's imagine that you are in a big city with a lot of traffic on the road, and you're about to step off the curb to cross the street. And just as you're about to do so, a car zips right around the corner, really close to the curb, and you leap back because he could have hit you and killed you so easily. And so you saw, boy, that was a near miss, and you jump back, and then the car zips off, no collision, no damage. And so within seconds, you recognize there's no danger now. The car's going that way, it's gone. How long does it take before your body settles down, that adrenaline rush, that seizure, like that? That could be minutes, it could be many minutes, it could be hours, if you're really shocked and traumatized by that. Oh, he missed me by that much, you know? And so intellectually, you've got it. There's just no danger. Okay, he was driving recklessly, that happens, but you weren't harmed, nobody was harmed, he's gone. But the impact on the body and the recovery of the body in terms of just the adrenaline system, if we speak of Western terminology, the muscles, the spasm, or if we speak in terms of first-person physiology of prana, energetically, it got shocked, perhaps even a bit traumatized, and it takes a longer time for recovery. So intellectually, you've got it all figured out, but that's going to be a slow trickle-down to your, literally, your gut feeling. Your gut feeling. And so there's a one of the most prominent neurologists in the United States is one by the name of Antonio Damasio. Very well known. He publishes a lot. And he's written a book called The Feeling of What Happens. And in the book, he makes a point that I think is largely true, that is a great deal of truth in it. And that is for whatever emotion we experience, and that's a whole array from joy, delight, fear, and so forth. He said whatever emotion we experience mentally, right? And it can be catalyzed mentally. Somebody may praise you or show you an enormous amount of affection. And you have this kind of very euphoric mental feeling. And it came from a verbal stimulus. And it really is mental. I mean, it pleased you. It's mental, right? But you may also kind of feel a warmth in the heart, maybe an affection for the person, a sense of gratitude, who knows what. But what his point is, whatever emotion you're feeling mentally, there's going to be some correlated somatic sensation, something you really feel in the body. And that's tactile. So you're actually picking it up with another sense, not with your mental awareness alone. You're picking it up with your tactile perception. So we have six modes of consciousness. You're picking it up with the tactile. So what to do? So there's an analysis, right? And it's just slower recovery. The body is slower to move. The Buddha said at one point, I can't quote him, but it's a very close paraphrase. He said, there is nothing that I see faster than in the whole world of nature. Nothing that I see is faster than the mind. And that means the body is going to be a really slow second, right? So what to do? What to do? Oh, I think it's time to give up my motto. Back to the infirmary. Because the infirmary is really somatic. I mean, I call it the infirmary for a very good reason. The infirmary, I mean, I'm using that word consciously, it's a place to rehabilitate, to restore your health, to get balanced, to revitalize, get nourished, and so forth, so you can venture out into the world again. But you've been injured, damaged, thrown out of balance by illness, injury, or what have you. So the infirmary, time to recuperate, right? So I think of this mind center as really a mental rehabilitation center, right? Because we're thrown out of balance by the world, which in many respects is really quite crazy. Quite crazy. And how can we not be influenced by a lot of the manic attitudes and behaviors and so forth around us? So here is, to a very large extent, including very much the staff, this, to my mind, just my subjective impression, this is something of an oasis of sanity. And we're here to cultivate greater sanity. Now, that may cause eruptions of really serious emotions and so forth and so on, but then we're here to deal with those. So once again, to let the body really calm down again, I'm going to take that analogy of the baby that was freaking out, you know, really hysterically crying. And so you calm it, you gentle it, but it's very somatic. Brain scientists have learned this, that a child that is held a lot and nurtured and cuddled, the brain develops much better than in a child that's just given all the food it needs, but just lies in a crib. So that personal contact, that feel, whether it's of a nanny, whether it's a mother, that actually is secondary. But that sense of being held, of nurtured, of soothed, the sound of the voice, the comforting, all of that, it's healing on many, many levels, right down to the biological, right? So I'm giving that as an analogy. Let yourself be a loving mother for yourself. And that's not impatient. So if the mother, I'm going to be a little bit in jest here, but if the mother has a baby that's just freaking out, said, come on, stop, you know, come on. Tries to, you know, speed it up a little bit. Not going to work very well. It's got to be just very loving and accepting and soothing and gentle, and that needs to be the approach. Back to the supine position. And that releasing, and breathing into the belly, because that's where a lot of the tension, a lot of the somatic sensations, gut fear, gut anger. And then sadness, I often see my heart is so heavy with sadness or depression or grief. That often is experienced at the heart and so forth. So short answer, summarize, infirmary is really good. And then as you're doing that, then here's a point, and this is why I wanted to segue, take your question and segue it over to the practice here. And that is, if you're practicing mindfulness of breathing and you're doing full body awareness, then those sensations of tightness, the clenched quality, the feeling, and this is a tactile sensation, but also a feeling. It's kind of unpleasant, something that grips your attention. As you're doing full body awareness, then those sensations arising in the gut, they're very much part of or within the domain of your focus of mindfulness. You're not trying to ignore them, exclude them, and so forth. You're attending to the body, they're arising in the body. Okay, welcome to the party, right? But now as you progress in your mindfulness of breathing, let's say you come up to the nostrils, okay, up here, but you're still feeling some gut sensation, you know, from some lingering emotional upheaval or what have you, then the practice here is to go ahead and just stay here. Just stay focused and not deliberately give attention here. When you're ready to do it, just focus here. And even though this is kind of calling for your attention, say, I'm sorry, I'm busy. I'm fully busy. I'm up here for the time being, so do what you want to do, but I'm here, you know. And so this points to actually a very important issue or fact of shamatha practice. And that is that when emotional upheavals arise, mental afflictions arise, anger, craving, hostility, whatever it may be, it's quite understandable to think that whatever's coming up, based on memories or some recent experience or whatever it may be, some upheaval is taking place, oh, we better take it seriously, focus on it, resolve it, work it out, what caused it, understand it, work with it, process it, deal with it, apply an antidote, and so forth. There's a place for that. Just to take one text, A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life by Shantideva is full of all type of specific remedies for specific mental afflictions, including a great big chapter on anger. Bring out this remedy, this perspective, this way of thinking. So on the one hand, that very active response using the specific types of meditation to calm the mind, to subdue mental afflictions, certainly has its place, no question. But it's easy to overlook the power of shamatha itself. And that is, there's a clear suggestion here that I utterly accept. And that is just the practice of developing single-pointed attention itself is not merely a cultivation of an attention skill, it can also be very healing. So if we think as you're practicing shamatha, then gradually you're developing these five jhana factors, your ability for coarse investigation, subtle analysis, right, single-pointed attention, and then also the bliss, the sense of well-being. These are arising. But these are arising just by practicing shamatha and progressing along the path of shamatha up towards dhyana, you're also overcoming what are called the five hindrances or the five obscurations. And these include ill will, animosity. They include kind of craving and attachment for hedonic pleasure. You're overcoming that, even though you're just focusing on your in and out breath. And of course, you overcome laxity and dullness, and you're overcoming excitation and restlessness, anxiety, and you're overcoming this vacillating, debilitating uncertainty or doubt. But the point here is that with this simple practice of shamatha, it actually can calm and subdue, attenuate a wide array of mental afflictions, even though we're not attending to them. So what that's suggesting is that the practice of shamatha is tapping into a potential in your body-mind that is a healing potential and allowing from a deeper source, an unconscious source, a non-conceptual source, allowing some kind of a healing power to arise and balance, soothe, and calm the mind. Okay? So I'm sure it's not the case that whatever mental addiction arises, you have to go into a big apothecary of, you know, antidotes for each one. But in fact, the practice of shamatha can actually remedy quite a few of them. So we're not attending to it, but it may be solved anyway, right? Now, here's a segue, and then we'll move on. Today we've shifted to another practice. And that is when we're fully involved in settling the mind in its natural state, full force of attention given to, and try to remember this now, if I ask, which I will later probably, what is the object of mindfulness when settling the mind in its natural state? There's only one right answer. You ready? The space of the mind and whatever arises within it. Space of the mind, whatever arises in it. Well, this means tactile sensations are not included. They're not in the space of the mind. They're in the tactile field. That's another field. The space of the mind is the space, the domain of experience in which uniquely mental events arise. Thoughts, dreams, emotions, desires, memories, and so forth. It's a sixth domain of experience. So somatic experiences, whatever. That's not where I'm focusing. I'm focusing on the mind. But within the mind, in that domain, this is certainly where emotions arise. So now if emotions are being churned up either by experiences outside of meditation or things being churned up because of your meditation, if an emotion arises while settling the mind in its natural state, then you do attend to it, and to the best of your ability, you attend to it without trying to modify it, without identifying with it, simply being present with it. And in that way, you may also discover through this practice that these emotions, especially the afflictive emotions, can unravel, can melt of their own accord, and dissipate without having to bring in some outside antidote. They actually heal from within. So this is very much a path of self-knowledge, of exploration of the healing capacities of your own body and mind. Okay? Is that sufficient?
Sorry,
go ahead. Good.
So if, let's say, the affliction or the feeling or whatever is very strong,
yeah,
and the focusing power yet is not very strong, then just go to infirmary.
Yeah. And I'll just reiterate now very briefly what I said yesterday. The infirmary is a really good option because it's so relaxing. You're just letting everything go, every out-breath, memories, thoughts, images, whatever, bye-bye. You know, just release them as much as you can. And you're not only releasing, but you're grounding in the earth element, the sensations of the breath and the body. So that may be very, very helpful for soothing, calming the troubled, turbulent mind. But if that's not working, if you find your mind is just churning, and you kind of release, and said, you know, it's stronger than you are. It's almost like, you know, like you're trying to let all the water go down the drain, but the tap is on full, and so as much as it's draining, you're still filling the bathtub higher and higher, okay? In that case, it's probably better to take a break. Just take a break. Go for a walk and try the other antidote. Go for a walk, and so if there's so many thoughts coming out, then let all of the space, the sky, be the repository for it. So then you let your awareness come out and you breathe and you bring your awareness into the body, into the visual, the auditory, and whatever thoughts come up, just let them dissipate into space. That's a great big repository. And breathe out, let your awareness come out, and that on occasion can be much more effective than trying to do this within the scope of the body in the infirmary. Okay? Good. All righty. Let's go to one written and then we'll go back to the verbal. See how time is going. We still have a half an hour. So what do we have cooking here? Today's mail. Oh yeah. Given that shamatha can only be achieved via a mental object, true statement, and therefore that attention upon the breath must at some point give way to attention to the counterpart sign. I will interrupt here. You don't go directly from the breath to the counterpart sign. There's a really, really big something in between, and it's called the acquired sign. So it goes classic Theravada. You go from the preliminary sign, that's the sensation of the breath at the nostrils. Then you go from there to the acquired sign. That's long before you achieve shamatha. And then when the counterpart sign arises, that's when you achieve shamatha. So you don't go directly from the preliminary sign to achieving shamatha. Okay? So three signs, preliminary, acquired sign, a counterpart sign. So given that, if one practices with one's eyes open, how, or does this, visual mental sign appear? Does it simply superimpose itself on or overwhelm the visual world? Good. Very good. In all of the shamatha practices we're engaging with here, if your eyes are open, in all of them, mindfulness of breathing or the other two, the eyes may be open, but they're just vacant. They're just vacant. That is, the eyes are open, but it's as if, kind of just imagine some Sunday afternoon, you're just lying and then lying out on the kind of grassy, out on the grass, staring up at the sky, and you're totally caught up in daydreaming. Okay? Just hither and yon. And your eyes are open. Well, it's kind of like, hello, anybody home? Because you're just totally caught up in your thoughts, right? So settling the mind in its natural state is not daydreaming, because daydreaming entails focusing on the referent of the thought. So you're going there and going there to future, past, and so forth. Whereas in settling the mind in its natural state, to the best of your ability, you're letting your awareness remain still in the present moment. So whatever thoughts come up, but you don't move. They come up, and then they just dissipate, right? But the point here is that in any of the three practices, if your eyes are open, but they're vacant. So you're not really attending to or deliberately attending to anything within the visual field. Now, if you're focusing on the sensations of the breath and you achieve stage 2, 3, 4, 5, something in that range probably, could be even a little bit later, and then the acquired sign arises. So bear in mind, the counterpart sign is mañana, much later. But you'll go from the preliminary sign to the acquired sign. The acquired sign is purely mental, which means you're already vacant here. And so, I mean, we can do it right now. You can have your eyes open. And can you right now really vividly imagine your mother's face? Can you remember what she looks like? Just your mother's face. Imagine her smiling at you right now. That image isn't really being superimposed upon the visual, is it? It's an entirely different domain of experience, right? So it wasn't competing with the visual. Your visual is kind of just fading out, and the more single-pointed you are, if you could achieve shamatha on your mother's face right now, your visual is going to go blank because you're just not feeding it. You're not giving any awareness to it at all, and also you won't hear anything, and you won't experience your body either because you're single-pointedly focusing on mama, right? So in a similar fashion, if your eyes are a little bit open, or however open they may be, and you're focusing on the tactile sensations right here at the apertures of the nostrils, and this is, by the way, the point of departure. I frankly do not think that if you're focusing still on the abdomen, that you'll move from that target to an acquired sign. I don't think so. You look at the classic Theravada teachings, and they always talk about being here. This is where the apertures of the nostrils, this is where the sensations get subtler and subtler and subtler. And you venture into that wonderful synergy, that very sweet synergy, in terms of the synergistic cultivation or deepening of relaxation, stability, and vividness. When you get into that flow, that's when, in this target area where you're focusing your attention, in that target area, there will arise an acquired sign. But it's arising purely in the mental domain, and it's not even really in competition with the visual, because it's a different domain of experience, right? So maybe I won't elaborate on this now. This can come maybe in a week or 10 days, whatever, if it's of interest. But that's what I would say for that. But you're quite right. I think there's very compelling evidence. You'll never achieve shamatha by focusing on any of the 5 physical senses. Sense fields, visual, auditory. You'll never achieve shamatha by reciting a mantra out loud. You can do it for 1,000,000 years. You won't achieve it because you're still caught up in the auditory and you're still caught up in activity. Whereas the practice of shamatha means utterly stilling your coarse mind. That means you're not moving here and doing this and doing that. You're stilling, you're shutting it down. You're dissolving it into the subtle continuum mental consciousness or bhavanga or substrate consciousness. Call it what you will. I think they're synonymous. So you must be focusing purely on in the mental domain, whether it's on a mental image, whether it's settling the mind in its natural state, whether it's awareness of awareness, Or you may take some visual object as a beginning, like if you'd like to do a visualization, you may focus on that white statue of the Buddha and start there by really focusing on it visually. But sooner or later, you have to take your eyes off of it and generate that image completely mentally. Okay? So, and I didn't see the name, and if there's no name, that's fine. I don't think there was. So that's the answer. If my answer is not clear, then please follow up. If it's clear, then we're cool. And we can go back then to any questions or comments, insights or observations. Yes, Miles.
Last night, well, throughout the day, I felt like I had a nice progression of progress. Uh-huh. And then at night, you know, I had probably my best session right before bed, and then I got into bed and I went to sleep and I woke up in the morning and I felt like something had happened over the course of the night that just completely obliterated and erased all my progress. And then mm-hmm. I was like groping all day mm-hmm. and probably didn't even come close to some place that I was yesterday. So I guess the question is sort of double and interrelated. And one has to do with the sense that something happened in the course of the night that reversed the progress. And then the other one is more generally about how to think about and understand, you know, understand the progression of progress as we go on through the course.
Very good. Very good. In the kind of one-page instruction on settling the mind in its natural state that I've taught, I think, countless times by now, by Lerap Lingba. You may have seen it. It's in the Attention Revolution. I cite it many, many times. One of the, and it's absolutely quintessential, really absolutely core instruction. And one of his lines, because there's no fat, there's nothing superfluous in any of his instruction. It's all important. And one of the points he makes is, do not take a short-sighted view of your meditation. Take in the big picture, right? So if we gave an analogy of investments, like investment in a company, you know, you first check out the company. Unless you're just one of the kind of gamblers, it's selling one day and buying the next day and always, you know, just really short-term investment. But if you're thinking, no, I'd like to invest and it's going to be a 10-year investment, then of course if you're going to do that, you check out the company really carefully. And you see, is this a sound company, good product, good administration, the CEO, the management, and so forth. You just check out it as well as you can. Say, this one has a lot of potential. I'm going to invest and it's going to be, I think in 10 years, it's going to turn out really well. But then imagine if you did that, and then in the morning you're looking, how did you do this morning? And then the afternoon, oh, it went down a half point. And I hope it goes better this evening. You're going to just be freaking out the whole time, you know? I'm going to be a millionaire. I'm going to be broke. I'm going to be, or I'm only going to get my capital out. Oh, no. Sound like a chimpanzee, you know? So there it is. Take a long-term view. If I had $10 for every person who told me I was going on really well in the practice, I had my best session, and the next day it sucked. It was terrible. I lost everything. If I had $10 for every time I've heard that, I could buy myself a motor scooter. Not a house, but you know, that'd be a lot of $10. It happens a lot, and not out of sheer accident, not by sheer accident. The nature of shamatha, most explicitly settling the mind in its natural state, but more implicitly, all other kinds of shamatha, is when it's going well, especially when you feel, oh, that was exceptional, that was about as good as I've ever experienced, the stability and so forth and so on. It's especially when you have a really good session or sequence of sessions. Sometimes it's a day and it's 2 days, 3 days, when it's getting really, oh, my stock is going well, the company's, I'm going to make a lot of money here, this is going well. Day one, day two, day three, and day four, crashed and burned, like, oh man, I'm back to day zero, you know? What's going on? Is especially when you have a sequence, like you had an afternoon. That's good. That's a nice little sequence. Sometimes it's going to be, you know, 3, 4, 5 days getting better, 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 and then crash and burn. What's going on here? And as I said, explicitly in settling the mind, implicitly in all shamatha practices, it's particularly in those sessions that really do seem to go well. That's when we're starting to dredge. That's when the kind of the knife of your attention is starting to settle deeper into the layers of your mind, And it stirs up stuff. It just stirs up stuff. It may manifest during the daytime. It may manifest in some really wild dreams. Dreams experiencing desires, emotions you don't normally experience. Like, whoa, where did that come from? You know? Where it came from? Well, it came from the only place it could be coming from, your mind. But you're tapping into deeper, deeper levels. And this goes on. If you're practicing in retreat 10 hours a day for months on end, well, after months, you'll still be dredging deeper and dredging out some really interesting stuff. And if you look, if you go back to the Attention Revolution or to my sources for that, because I didn't make up anything significant there, go back to the sources, get up there to stage 6, you're really quite well along the path, right? Stage 6 out of 9, that's not bad, right? And then lo and behold, there you're on stage 6. I mean, that's really some major progress. And then you see, what are some of the common experiences that come up on stage 6? Lust, depression, incredible lethargy. You say, man, that sucks. I mean, that I thought we left that behind at stage 2. You know, really gross stuff coming up. And you see the longer list. I gave that also in the Attention Revolution. And then it comes up again in Stilling the Mind when I go to the source. Dujum Limba giving about 2.5 pages of the nyam, which he calls signs of progress. And this is like paranoia, insomnia, grief, like, you know, like a mother camel that just lost her calf. I mean, they just cry, you know. And racking pain in your body, inability to eat, you feel so full of nausea, and so forth. These are thumbs up, you know. It's good on you, mate. You know, this is, you're really getting on there. And these come up especially on stage 6. They can happen at stage 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but stage 6 is where you're getting into the ring with Muhammad Ali. You're getting the crap beat out of you, you know, really. And these are all signs of progress. So if you kind of know that in advance, then number one, you won't be thinking, oh boy, I wonder how long it will be before I get to stage 6, you know, when I really get beat up, you know. So you won't be taking stage 2, 3, 4, 5, and so forth as targets or as goals and then getting frustrated that you're not achieving them as fast as you thought. But it can be enormously beneficial to see, hey, yogis have been doing this, really intense yogis, for 2,500 years, and this is what they're reporting. You can be even on stage 6 and still have crappy sessions. You know. But they're not crappy sessions. They're good sessions. That's why he calls them signs of progress. But they're not easy. The emotions, the memories, the desires, the sadness, the grief, the despair, the anxiety, all of these can still be coming up. But it's not coming up out of the blue. And you're not getting it, that is, these are not being inserted into your mind by engaging in some exotic, weird, kooky practice. Because you're not inserting anything into your mind at all. You're observing it, but you're dredging deeper and deeper and deeper. So it's good that you've had this experience very early on. What I can say is, get used to it. Right? And then just take it in stride. Just take it in stride. Like, as if you've put your money into a company, invested your money in the company, and say, look, I'm going to be watching it, but I'm not even planning to take my money out for 10 years because I have confidence in this company. And it'll have its dips, and the economy will go up and down, but this is a good company. It's a good product. I have trust in it, and this is a 10-year investment. So I'll keep my eye on it, but I'm not going to be freaking out every day or even every month. I'm going to be watching, okay, how did it do after 6 months? How did it do after 2 years? Having that approach, this is really a sign of maturity in the practice. I'm speaking spirit. I'm not saying you're immature. I'm saying a sign of spiritual maturity. And this is what I've noticed, because I've known yogis who've spent 20, 30 years in retreat. And man, do they're like an ocean unmoved by waves. You know? I mean, they're just such calm. And I've never had any sense from any of them. I have a number of them by now. Of, gosh, I'm impatient. I wish I could progress more. My practice isn't going as fast as I thought it would. They're just spending their whole life in Dharma. Because there's nothing else to do from their perspective. And so it goes fast, it goes slow, it goes up, it goes down. Hey, it's the only thing worth doing. So they just sliding on through. And that's a real sign of maturity. So that's what I say. So when you have the really bad days, and you could be, you could have another one. You know, before the 7.5 weeks is over, you might have another one. In which case, when that happens, you can always go back to the infirmary. You can always go back for a walk. I think I won't give a more elaborate answer. There's a lot more material, but we don't have to do it all in one day. Or if you're up to it, then when you see all the junk arising, the thoughts, the memories, and so forth and so on, if you're up to it, if you're grounded enough, you're relaxed enough, then you can face right into that hurricane of all the thoughts that are coming up and just be right there. Give it your best shot. And observe whatever's coming up. And just let it arise and pass, but without being sucked up into it and carried away. Okay? Anything else? Okay. Now we'll go back and do one more. It looks like short, so I like short. Oh, not that short. It looks so promising. Okay, let's see what it has. Okay. And this is fine. It's anonymous. I'm happy with that. So, for several days, I've had symptoms of so-called lung, a sharp discomfort in the center of the chest, throat, or stomach, headache, head band that aspirin doesn't cure. Okay? Good. Good to notice it quickly. I'm mostly doing full body awareness in the supine, attention to rise and fall of the abdomen, moves, the feeling down. I don't want to try the third moon now. Good call. Now is not a time to come up to the nostrils. Is this a tactile sensation in the body? Yeah, lung. Lung is a Tibetan word for vata. And I've given you another word you may not know. Say again. Well, that's okay, lung, that's actually hlakpa. Hlakpa is wind. And then lung is air. Oh, say again, what? I didn't understand. Another earthquake. I'm on too soft a cushion here. Do you want to enjoy it? So a little aftershocks, they're so common, yeah? Oh, yeah, I picked up that one. Yeah. I wonder if that would even register a 2 where we are. That was a really gentle murmur. Good. I think no reason to run out. Okay. So, but we know that this is the beauty of having so many doors here. You know, you escape through any door you like, I think. So lung. Since this is a Tibetan term, let's bring this into English. Lung is, in Sanskrit, vata, which is the air humor or the wind humor. And this is a constitutional type. So there's wind people, there's bile people, there's phlegm people. So wind is vata. And so when you have a wind disorder or a lung disorder, and people in Tibetan Buddhism talk about this all the time, especially Westerners, then there are both somatic sensations or symptoms as well as psychological. Okay? The somatic or the tactile is often a kind of heaviness of the heart, a tightness around the shoulders, sometimes a tightness in the face, overall a sense of tension, of constriction, perhaps heaviness. You may also feel a kind of a heaviness at the heart. So this is all somatic, right? But then it's psychologically you may feel a bit on edge, uneasy, a bit sad or depressed, a bit anxious possibly, ill at ease, could be a bit hot-tempered, and so all of those. So it's very psychosomatic, and when you see this coming up, it's definitely a time, nip it in the bud, respond quickly. This is not something to make a habit. So when you see either of these somatic or psychological symptoms coming up, that's a time to throttle back, ease off, go for a walk, go eat something nice, eat some chocolate, you know, or go over to the Divine. They have a lot of good food over there. You know, you can afford a little snack. They have very good snacks, excellent desserts. Here's a little pitch for the Divine. But throttle back. You know, take it easy. If you want to, I'm not encouraging you to go to the sports center. But if that's something you'd like to do, that would be a really good time. Go for a nice swim, whatever. But just or for free, just go out for a walk. Time to ease off. Don't push. Ease off. And then you may do some reading and so forth, but not a time to push, you know, put kind of think, I'll just push my way through it. Push your way through it, it'll just get worse. Okay? So, going to the infirmary, good idea. Abdomen, probably a good idea. Going for a walk, good idea. Not coming up to the sensations of the nostrils, good idea. So, is this a tactile sensation in the body? That's part of it. It's tied to the breath. Arousing attention or the in-breath will fan the discomfort. Yet now is not a time for arousal, not a time for kind of tightening up, cinching up, concentrating, big emphasis on releasing, big emphasis on letting go and relaxing more and more deeply with every out-breath. if you like to stay inside the body, all gentle, soothing baby, that kind of thing, not the time to even crack the whip a little bit. I would not even count. I would not, when you're there, not even the time for the discipline of counting the breaths. Too tough. Too tough. So loosen up. Just let it be soothing. Okay? Where's the muscle to relax or release? All of them. All of them. Right? That's why the supine position is so good. Is there a way to finesse relaxing this? I don't think I can say much more than I have already. You might also, though, and that is, okay, out-breath. Releasing fully with out-breath. Release all the way through the end of the out-breath. Let that next breath flow in effortlessly. I've said that a number of times. I stand by it. Be very helpful in kind of letting off that excess energy, which is lung, okay? Releasing it. But you might also check with diet and exercise. So we want to be just as clever and as contemporary, traditional and contemporary as we can. Check with your diet. If you have a vata disposition, if you tend to be a bit hyper, your mind pretty active, light, you talk quickly, you move quickly, kind of really restless by temperament, then it would be good to balance that with your diet and with exercise. So for you, jogging may not be the best thing. Walking may be better. Yoga could be spot on, because it doesn't agitate, doesn't stir up the system, right? Tai Chi, Qigong could be very good. But something grounding, something soothing, something slower, walking can be fine, all of that. And then you may look at diet. There's diet for Vata people, diet for Kapha people, and diet for Vata Pitta Kapha, Vata Pitta Pitta. So for each of the three humors, there are diets to balance out the imbalance that is there. So for people who are Vata, I'll just stick with that and not give a whole talk on Ayurvedic medicine or Tibetan medicine. If you're just generally prone to that kind of thing, of getting a bit tense, tight, getting lung symptoms and all of that, then grounding food. Animal protein, I'm not advocating eating meat. If you don't need it, excellent. But if you are a meat eater, meat is actually very beneficial for people with a Vata disposition. It's grounding, it stabilizes. It's just part of the tradition. If you, by ethical principles, don't want to eat meat, I salute you. Very good. But if meat is part of your diet, that can be helpful. Butter can be helpful. Oils can be helpful. Carbohydrates can be helpful. Anything to ground, to stabilize, can be helpful, whereas really light foods like salads, uncooked vegetables and so forth, not that great. Cold drinks, not that great. Better warmer drinks, and not caffeine, or if you take caffeine, really dilute tea. Coffee probably will not be helpful. Strong tea will not be helpful. Anything that agitates or rouses or kind of jacks you up, not helpful. Okay? So approach it from diet, from exercise, from meditation, and overall, just the spirit of loving kindness. Be gentle with yourself, loving with yourself. Don't push. Take it easy. Again, baby in the arms kind of attitude. I'm cautious so it won't spin out of control. You're cautious at just the right time. When it's just starting, now's the time to attend to this, and don't let it start building up a kind of a habit or momentum, because you would indeed waste a lot of time. But more than that, you could really harm yourself. As it comes on, I move focus down to the earth or the feet and watch the sensation out of the corner of my eye, so to speak. Where's the release point? You're making all the right moves. Very intelligent response, good response. And if I can be of any further assistance one-on-one, let me know. But that's my initial response right now. Okay? That's the best I can offer for right now. Okay, we have still some minutes left. Insights, observations, questions, anything coming up, especially pertaining to the practice.
I just want to ask in relation to that question, because yes, I think it's important.
And your name is Quinn.
Quinn, yes. Yeah. In regards to Mick's question, you suggested that in some cases there might be some anxiety or some feelings in the body. You can go to the nose and just ignore those. Those might resolve themselves.
That's right.
In a lung situation, you suggested not going to the nose because it might aggravate it.
Yeah.
Can you clarify which symptoms?
I'd be happy to, sure. Okay. Especially if the lung can manifest in different ways. This is a small target. Number one, that already implies concentration, which can, if you're kind of bringing an agitated mind to that, that can already be kind of stressful, like claustrophobic almost, right? But especially if the lung is manifesting, a lung or wind disorder, if we kind of put this into weird English, a wind disorder, And it's a nervous disorder. It's a nervous imbalance. It's kind of it's tension, anxiety, stress. Overall, it's stress. If the symptoms of the stress are manifesting in the head, like a tightness around the jaws, pressure in the head, headaches coming on, overall kind of a heaviness here in the head, just don't go here at all. Do not go to the... That's just going to bring more energy into the head, and it's going to compound or aggravate the symptoms, right? General rule of thumb, wherever you focus your attention in the body, you will be drawing energy to that area. And it's physiological. It's prana. Prana is physical, but it's not material. Prana is not made of atoms, as are understood in modern physics, but they are physical. And anybody who's practiced Tummo or observed people who are highly accomplished in Tummo, which is all about directing the prana, there can hardly be any doubt that it's physical, because they're doing having a massive impact on the body by generating incredible levels of heat in the body, and it's all through the manipulation of prana. So prana is physical, and this is a good case in point. I won't elaborate much, but when you're practicing Tummo, you're bringing single-pointed, high-powered concentration, samadhi, to the focal point right in the navel chakra, four finger widths beneath the navel. You're honing in there really like a laser, and you're igniting a chakra there that just can go in, like almost like opening up a blowtorch and opening up a tremendous amount of heat and energy, right? But how does that happen? Because you're focusing your samadhi there, the energies come in like, you know, like iron filings coming into a magnet, and then that has a lot of effects, which can be very benign, very helpful. But there's the point. If you focus your attention here at the nostrils, you are bringing prana there. And if you already have an excess of energy, kind of stagnating, condensed, heavy energy in the head, that's going to make it worse. Okay? Whereas if it's just more of I didn't have the sense that what Amik was talking about was a vata disorder or having a problem of lung, but simply a residual, a tightness, a somatic sensation of something, discomfort and so forth in the abdomen. Not so much a vata disturbance, but simply a repercussion of earlier issues that were being dealt with. If that's all it is, then coming up here is, number one, moving away from the problem, because the somatic sensation where all the energy is congealing is in the gut. You're coming up here, that can already begin to diffuse it. Okay? So if the symptoms of the vata or wind disorder are in the head, don't go to the nostrils. And generally come here to the nostrils if and only if you do have a pretty good degree of ease, of comfort, so this is not contracting, tightening like that, but more just a nice, soft target that is small. Is that clear? Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. Anything else for a short time? Hola, so. So there's a nice aphorism, as we have just a minute or two, a nice aphorism from the Tibetan tradition, half of which especially is good to attend to now, the other half not quite so relevant to our situation. But the aphorism is about ethics, actually, and that is, when with others, watch your speech, watch your mouth, right? That you don't say anything injurious, harmful, right? When alone, watch your mind. And since we're generally maintaining silence here, that makes it easy to watch the speech. So nothing's happening. It's an empty cinema, right? But when we're on our own or walking over to the canteen, we're going back to our rooms, taking a walk, what have you. Now especially, now that we've ventured into this settling the mind, while on the one hand, it's a very good practice, maintaining a peripheral awareness of the in and out breathing, but it's also a really good idea in between sessions, in a light way, a peripheral way, just as if you're driving, you know, driving along and just now and again checking on the dashboard. Is your engine overheating? RPM's getting too high? All the doors locked? And so forth and so on. How's your gas level? Are you running out of gas? And so forth. You're checking it now and again. Every responsible driver does that. So likewise, check up at least now and again. How's your mind doing? You know, getting agitated? Calm? Dopey? Afflicted? What have you? So, or just what's going on, what's, you know, the latest infomercial arising in your mind, and just seeing what's coming up. But maintaining that peripheral awareness, that metacognitive awareness of what's arising and passing in the mind, really good practice. And even if it's just a very peripheral, while you're giving most of your attention to eating your meal or whatever it may be, maintaining that peripheral awareness there, then when you go into your next session, whether it's mindfulness of breathing or settling the mind, it's a smoother segue. You don't feel a big discontinuity, but more that was peripheral, and now it's central. Then the session's over, now it's more peripheral, and I'm taking a walk, and I'm refreshing my mind. I'm letting my awareness come out into the sky, into nature, and so forth. But I'm still keeping an eye on, as you say, out of the corner of the eye, what's going on in the mind. You okay? You okay? Okay? So that's enough for now. Enjoy your meal. See you tomorrow.